Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to New Books in Technology, a podcast on the New Books Network. I'm Jari Peters, your host. Today, Professor Sonia Livingstone has joined us to talk about her book, Parenting for a Digital Future, How Hopes and Fears About Technology Shape Children's Lives. The book is co-authored with Alicia Blum-Ross, who is a public policy lead for kids and families at Google. Professor Livingstone is a professor in the Department of Media and Communications at the London School of Economics and Political Science. Her research examines how the changing conditions of mediation are reshaping everyday practices and possibilities for action. She has published 20 books on media audiences, specifically focusing on children and young people's risks and opportunities, media literacy, and rights in the digital environment. Professor Livingstone currently directs the Digital Futures Commission with the Five Rights Foundation and the Global Kids Online Project with UNICEF, along with various other prestigious affiliations. Professor Livingstone, thank you for joining me today to discuss this really interesting book, Parenting for a Digital Future.
It's a pleasure to be here with you, Jari. Thank you so much.
So I found this book both fascinating and provocative, and I definitely want to get into some of the reasons why. So we definitely have a lot to talk about, but maybe you could start us off and tell us how you came to write the book.
Sure. I have done research with children and families in relation to media technologies, actually a media change, for many years. And my focus has always been on children. And that's what people always ask me about. And it was kind of only recently I realized that parents don't get much of a voice, and parents are even kind of conceived of as quite kind of problematic. This sort of deficit theory of parents are somehow failing children and not living up to their kind of societal expectations. And I wanted to get parents' side of it. And we did the work actually when Alicia was still a research fellow at the London School of Economics. So she's an anthropologist, I'm a psychologist, and we kind of wanted to use the lens of parenting really to kind of open up the transformations that families and all of us are living through as we kind of move into ever more kind of digitally complex lives.
And so the book comes out of, correct me if I'm wrong, comes out of a national study approximately 73 families that you all interviewed in London.
Right. We began with the in-depth qualitative research, and we it was a bit ethnographic. We kind of worked in and around these various digital media learning sites where it seemed to us that some people were gravitating as a way of sort of embracing a digital future. And we wanted to understand what was drawing some people to those sites and to want to gain those skills. Sometimes it was coming more from the parents, sometimes from the child. And then we realized at a certain point that we felt we were onto understanding something about how families were reshaping themselves to embrace these kind of new possibilities. And then we did the national survey because we wanted to be sure that we were, you know, the claims we were making were kind of representative, and also to dig in a little bit to some of the more minority or particular experiences that, you know, you can't quite see in a sample of 73, but you can see when you've got 2,000 families. So it was trying to kind of use the quantitative to contextualize and as a sort of check on the on our basically qualitative approach.
Right. And can you take us through sort of the qualitative approach? I just want to maybe explore that a little bit, especially since, you know, as I was looking at the at some of the data in the towards the end of the book, it seemed like you all really tried to ensure that you had a broad swath of different types of families represented by different socioeconomic statuses, nationality statuses, and various families from different countries. Could you talk a little bit about why that was important to the process?
Sure. I mean, the project kind of grew organically, beginning in London, and it really is centered in London. But of course, London is a global city. And so as a global city, it attracts a lot of inward investment from, you know, kind of entrepreneurs and digital enterprises. And it also, as a kind of very multicultural city, it becomes a kind of hub for creativity and innovation and, you know, kind of experimentation really with what the digital future is going to be. And my sense in beginning the project was that, you know, this is people's lives. They are kind of committing to that sense that there is something to be explored and experimented with in relation to technologies that can give a kind of form and set of possibilities to their lives in a way that is distinctive. So qualitative research sort of sets itself the task not of trying to be representative, but trying to explore the available diversity and difference in experience. So, you know, we began in these various digital media kind of learning settings. One was rather affluent, one was kind of more middle class, and one was in a really low income neighborhood attached to a kind of very multi-ethnic school where people had very little money. So we kind of positioned ourselves in these three sites, and then we branched out, meeting different people, being introduced along the way to other families, not all of whom were so kind of fascinated with the digital. But we did kind of keep an eye on, you know, are we getting the experience of people of different income groups, of people with different kind of cultural backgrounds and values, of different kinds of family composition. So we definitely wanted those different experiences. And we, you'll have seen in the book, we have a chapter also on families where the children have special educational needs and disabilities. And that was important to us really to kind of, you know, overcome that sense that that you see in the adverts all the time, that the family who use the internet are rather affluent, rather white, rather kind of able-bodied, and that everything is, you know, very happy, as it were. Right. I mean, we really wanted to kind of look behind at the reality of what is family's experience and what are all the differences that we should contend with.
Right. Yes. I you know, following this this research, I definitely see a more of a nuance in this book and the approach that you both took here, because I think you're right. I think when we read in this area, particularly where parents, well, really children, right, are the focus. As you said, parents are rarely the focus unless they're being there are these diatribes against, you know, how parents do their parenting, if you will. And so I think it was really interesting to see this approach that provided us, or at least, you know, the intention was to provide some nuance, and maybe not so much according to the established category. So let's maybe get more into that. What were some of the dilemmas that you found were common, both common and different amongst the diversity of the parents that you all interviewed?
Maybe I can give some kinds of examples. I'm just thinking, for example, one family where we interviewed the kind of the separated, the mum was separated from her partner and the children, but she had built a kind of a super high-tech home. She didn't have a lot of money, but she'd kind of gone all out as a kind of geeky home to provide a sort of a cultural space where she and her sons, when they came to visit, would engage and invite their friends. And she was kind of rebuilding an idea of family and of future that gave her a really kind of viable and distinctive relationship with her her sons, and gave them all a kind of shared narrative and identity that was very positive. And clearly there was kind of sadness and heartache, you know, kind of behind in the scenes. And we saw that in a number of families, actually. But there was also this kind of embrace of a geeky digital future as a path that she felt she had kind of agency over. And if I think of another family, much poorer, and a mother who had migrated from East Africa and was putting everything into providing the tech for her daughters to give them a kind of future. And the technology had become the symbol, if you like, of why she'd migrated, why she'd made this kind of huge move as a to difficult London, not always very welcoming London, but she had this investment, and the technology symbolised that. And she couldn't really understand it; she couldn't use it. Some of it was broken. But her daughters, who were, you know, I think one of the older girl was only about 10, she could use it, and it was such a symbol of hope for that mother to put the money in that she could kind of scrape together. And again, build a kind of vision of the family going forward that gave her hope, even though she didn't really quite understand what those possibilities were. You know, we kind of had lots of stories like that of people. I think it is a bit London or, you know, the global city, in the sense that because people see non-standard pathways being enabled and facilitated in a large, very kind of multicultural city, they sort of squeeze themselves in. So we interviewed lots of families where they had very little space to live and very little money, but a sense that they wanted to be part of that kind of buzzing new possible lifestyles and ways of stepping out of the kind of very constraining norms that they felt they might have, you know, struggled against in other places.
Right. So there's the trade-off that's sort of represented in the book. I wonder.
Maybe I can just say, I mean, a kind of investment in technology that is more than the technology itself, you know, merits in a way, but that, you know, when we say in the subtitle of the book, how hopes and fears about technology shape children's lives, those hopes and fears often are motivated by the struggle to make sense of a major migration in one's life, or the struggle to rebuild a viable family future after relationship breakdown, or the ways in which the parents of children with special needs and disabilities, you know, didn't see a future for themselves, really. But with technology, they felt there was a kind of a workaround. So the investment in technology is an investment in technology, but it's also an investment in family, and it's an investment in the future.
Right. And I, you know, it's very interesting, because I think that was very clear as you sort of led us through your interactions with the different families. But what something that I definitely want to come back to a little bit later in the interview, was this pretty sober observation that you all had about, you know, sort of the trajectory of each type of family. And, you know, sort of based on other studies, how trajectories were rarely subverted. So if there was, you know, for instance, your elite affluent family, you know, their boys were going to continue to, you know, sort of be successful and have the access to the higher level coding camps. Versus, you know, one of the other families who, while they had access to certain coding opportunities, they weren't necessarily at the level of the elite families, and what that meant for potential life chances, right? And so, we will definitely come back to that because I think it's a very interesting observation, notwithstanding sort of the hope that you all kind of talk about with all of the families, right? Or about all of the families.
I mean, maybe just to kind of comment now, I think that's right. It's one of the, maybe it's not quite a paradox, but, you know, if you get that qualitative kind of perspective working within a family and getting their confidence and, you know, you hear their hopes and those do shape the actions that they take, mm-hmm. and they do shape the kind of narrative that they tell for where they, you know, what they want for their children and where they're trying to go. And they influence the decision, the purchasing decisions and which coding camp they put their kids into. And all of those things, the hopes matter in really substantive ways, but that's not the same as saying they are enough to deliver on the vision. And right. That's where that kind of, you know, we have to look at the wider social science, which tells us that overall social mobility is not very good. Basically, mainly people kind of stay in the sort of ranking in life that they've been allotted by, you know, how they were born and what opportunities they had. We've lived through, I think, in both the US and in Britain, we've lived through a series of decades in which every family could hope that their children were going to do better. And in terms of income and demographics, they often did. But that's changing. And the last, you know, couple of decades have been a kind of a plateau at best. And for some parents, you know, their children will not do as well as they have in terms of education or income. And so, you know, we kind of heard these hopes from many parents for many reasons, often centered on the technology. But we were also reading that wider social science literature that says, by and large, it's inequalities that are rising, not social mm-hmm. mobility. It's, you know, parents are trying to do the right things, but that doesn't mean that they can really give their child the leg up to new, you know, sort of overcome the obstacles that they also face in their life. So that was a kind of, it was sobering in a way to listen to people's hopes, but kind of know the social science on what's most likely to happen.
Yeah, I mean, I thought that was, I mean, just to follow this thread, I thought that was a very, as I said before, a sobering kind of observation. And I wonder what you think the impact of knowing that for families might be. I'm thinking about I believe it's the Tybalt family, and how the father expressed that he expected his boys to essentially to be ahead of others. And it was definitely what you all shared with us about that conversation. There was definitely a sense of, that there's an expectation for our children, the Tybalt children, to be ahead of everyone else. And sort of this comparison, this comparative sort of sense that he felt was sort of appropriate, even though his wife tried to, you know, soften his language, to the extent that he said, you know, that for anyone to be considered a gentleman, right? And once my children grow up, they will need to know what this technology means, how to use it, you know, beyond just sort of the bank tellers, I think was the example.
Right. I think he said something like, you know, I want them to learn Python and Java and whatever they need to learn so that they end up in the tech boardroom, not in the basement.
Right. Right.
And, you know, and of course, getting a job in technology could mean either the boardroom or, you know, kind of error trapping and, you know, low level work in the basement, as it were. And many parents who set their sights on, you know, the jobs that haven't been invented yet that are coming down the line and that we're supposed to be preparing our children for, if that's ever possible. But many parents don't know, well, what are those jobs that haven't been invented with? And, you know, so preparing your child to get in the boardroom is, you know, kind of almost impossible, really. But I think it meant that a lot of parents were thinking about the practical steps they could take. Okay, they could, you know, try to buy the technology at home, even though for poorer parents that was often a disproportionate financial investment, and actually investment of kind of space and rearranging the house compared to wealthier parents. And they could look out for where there are coding camps or kind of digital media learning opportunities in their neighborhood, and they could try to kind of point out, you know, and encourage the possibilities. And, you know, often parents are very kind of practical, and they take the step that's in front of them, and that's, you know, that it may be beneficial. I'm not saying for none of them will get anywhere, but it is certainly very striking when you talk to the more privileged families, mm-hmm. how confidently they feel they have the kind of resources and expertise and connections to reproduce their position of privilege.
Right, right. And so it's more than just the practical sort of approaches, or maybe we might say that their practical approaches are, you know, just so different than a family that's struggling financially, especially as you talk about, talk about the networks, right, that different families have access to. I mean, just a fascinating conversation. To sort of switch gears, I kind of want to talk about some of the things that you all sort of challenge the reader to not take for granted. So for instance, this concept that screen time is somehow a meaningful category. You all seem to argue that screen time is more of a scapegoat as opposed to a data point that really tells us anything.
Right. I mean, I had not thought that this book was going to include screen time as a theme when beginning the work, but parents kind of fed it back to us so much. And they talked about this sense of, or it kind of emerged, this sense of a bind that on the one hand, they want to get their kids ahead to prepared for those jobs that haven't been invented yet, that are going to need the investment in technology and digital skills and so forth. But on the other hand, they've got a very strong message. They have to limit screen time. They have to kind of monitor and control and police what their children are doing online, because screen time is bad and will rot their brains and impede their safety and well-being. And they felt, you know, these were like two completely conflicting narratives. Mm-hmm. And the best kind of resolution they could come up with was a kind of balance of, you know, a certain amount of screen time and then a certain amount of something else. But that led them into all kinds of conflicts, both with their kids who might be gamers and for whom, you know, 2 hours is nothing, and, you know, much longer game playing is really important, or coders, or kids who are, you know, learning online. And it also lacked the nuance that you know, in our field, we really know is important, which is what kind of screen time, you know, what are the kids doing online and how does that fit into their lives and what connections and possibilities does it open up for them or maybe close down for them? So the judgments that I think in kind of social science around technology that we would kind of want to hear prioritized weren't familiar to the parents who were just getting this, you know, look at your watch, how long have they been on, turn it off kind of a message. So screen time became a kind of an indicator in a way, not only of how parents were sort of a bit left in a outdated debate in some ways, but also all those advising them, you know, the health visitors and the teachers and the, you know, the kind of, and their peers, other parents and their parents, are kind of talking the screen time debate when, you know, and often it came from the American Academy of Pediatrics with its kind of famous 2-hour rule. But the American Academy of Pediatrics rethought that rule several years ago. But, you know, that doesn't filter through. And they rethought it because of the kind of research evidence that says actually what really matters is the content and the context and the connections that screens may build or may impede and make a more nuanced judgment. So, you know, screen time also symbolizes in a way that parents are a bit left out of the loop and that they need kind of better support and better guidance.
Right. I think that is so helpful for our readers. Oftentimes, I think, you know, we definitely have situations where parents are given contradictory messages, right? So one expert says, you know, screen time is the marker. Another expert says it's not necessarily the marker, and so it presents a real challenge for parents who are just trying to get it right.
I agree, and I, you know, of course, I'm one voice among many, and I know there are experts who disagree with me. I think where experts would agree with each other is looking beyond how we get to well-being to what we mean by well-being. Right. And I think even if, you know, there are still arguments, of course, about screen time and about whether tech is good or bad, addictive or, you know, empowering and so on. But I think what everyone agrees on is we want our kids to be creative, to have self-esteem, to sleep well and eat well, to have kind of good relations with their friends and their family, to be, you know, studying and enjoying their schoolwork, to be physically fit and have chance for exercise. You know, I don't think there's the same debate. The only question is, does the technology help or hinder in those kinds of goals? And there my message might be, yes, you know, the experts continue to argue, but we saw so many different solutions from families. And I think one of the kind of pernicious myths that traps many families is that everyone else is doing it right and you're kind of, you know, struggling, but they've all got it sorted and they've all got their balance and their 2-hour rule and so on. But we were just overwhelmed by how different those 73 families were. And what different kinds of resolution and balance and, you know, back to the family who decided to kind of completely geek out and that would be their way. You know, those kids were doing well in school and they were fit and they were sleeping. But they all, you know, loved this world of computing and coding together. And other families who were prioritizing the creative, you know, there was the Jacob and Daisy's family who were just kind of prioritizing being artistic and creative. And if the tech could help with that, great. And when the tech seemed to get in the way, well, let's go out to the park and run around. And, you know, so different ways, different kind of settlements, not all of them happy, not all of them easy, but definitely no sense that other families are all getting it right or other families are all doing it the same. And it's, you know, you that are somehow failing.
Right. You know, to that point, I found that if we can talk a little bit about some of the projections. I mean, you mentioned that some of the some parents felt like they were not necessarily doing it right, or you know, feeling that they were struggling with it more so than others. One of the observations that I found with this book and some other studies similar to some of the concepts you all engage in or cover here, I found that some parents were more likely to discuss their impressions about other parents. And I wonder if that, and almost in terms of like a deficit discourse, right? So assuming that, for instance, parents of a different socioeconomic status, a lower socioeconomic status, did not necessarily have all the tools or the wherewithal to sort of appropriately guide their children. And we see this in the literature too, right? In a lot of studies that sort of embrace those kinds of assumptions. And I sort of wondered if you saw the opposite of that. Did you see, parents in some of the other communities, immigrant communities, et cetera, sort of talk about other parents and or families in higher economic statuses and what they thought they were doing?
Yeah, I think in some ways parents are hyper aware of what other families might be doing and how they might be doing it better, and that makes parents kind of anxious and feel bad. They were also critically reflective on that. So we had some kind of interesting conversations about, those when parents meet at the school gates, perhaps to pick up the kids, or they kind of knew that they were only telling part of the story, and that they would do the bit that they could brag, or that they might make the judgment, harsh judgment of others, or that they would be receiving that harsh judgment, and that wasn't the whole story. And so they felt the parent shaming, but they were also kind of aware that it was somehow invented, sort of part of the game, because there was also this sense that when they were in their own home with the front door closed, they had a bit more leeway to do it their way. Mm-hmm. And some of those judgments disappeared, and they kind of knew that, they were a family that liked a lazy morning, and everyone would pile into bed together and watch a movie, and that's what they did on Sundays, and they don't care what other families do. That was the kind of their time. Or other, families where, they liked to kind of go in the kitchen and cook something together, and they'd have kind of YouTube for the or a way of, getting the recipes, and they would be using the tech, and everyone would be half on their phones but also doing something together, and that was their thing. And lots of stories like that where they just felt if they'd found their ways of coming together and relaxing together in some ways, then the other things that everyone did separately, where the parents felt less control over the kids, those were a bit less important, because they knew, there was the kind of the core of the family life was going well. And when that wasn't going well, then everything was anxious. So, I think of one single parent family, reasonably affluent, but their father had died recently, and the mother and son were just, they were just living in their separate worlds, each in a kind of world of sadness. And the boy was upstairs gaming a lot, and the mum was kind of downstairs worrying a lot. And, they hadn't. So when they were behind their front door, it wasn't happy. And the technology did pull them apart, because she didn't understand what he loved. So it wasn't so much about the comparison of what other families are doing. It was, I think it's a lot of very kind of internal struggles, really, between the parent and the child, and parents kind of trying to, in some ways, respect the children for who they are and what they want to do, and in other ways, feeling terribly burdened that they've got to get their kids to be in a certain way and want them to be in a certain way. And, so every day, so many everyday struggles came out in this book, so many ways in which just the most ordinary mundane activities were the source of fights, and the sense that big values were at stake, and the future was at stake if we don't get it right. And, you know, parents feel pretty kind of powerless in lots of those struggles.
Right. And could you talk a little bit about the struggle of trying to and wanting to get it right, but also you know, this sort of feeling of wanting to allow children to self-actualize, and how technology might be able to help in some ways, and also hinder that self-actualization.
Mm. So I think that's the biggest struggle of parenting. You want to protect your child, and you want to guide them, and they want to be, you know, increasingly kind of independent and go their own way and assert themselves. And we see this from the kind of the toddler on, really, and definitely in the teenager. So technology has entered into that debate in recent years, and that's kind of struggle. Why? Because it offers so many options that seem quite significant, you know, both in terms of values and in terms of risks, that it becomes the focus of the struggle between the parent and the child. Also because the technology has become so personalized. So, you know, gone are the days of television where the parent knew what the child was watching and could talk about it, as we used to advise. And now everyone is in their kind of own personalized bubble. So the chances for the parent to kind of mediate and understand and even share with the child seem difficult. And then thirdly, perhaps because the technology is so complex, that it's something that the child often feels much more at home with and kind of confident in using, while the parent is sort of struggling to understand and realize what options are even available for them. So they kind of feel a bit, you know, kind of outsmarted. So I think for all of those reasons, what is a struggle between child and parent that's as old as human history has got this kind of new twist and this in the digital age, and this new kind of intensity that focuses everyone on fighting about, you know, how long have you been on that game, or, you know, are you young enough to have your own phone yet, or, you know, should you be doing this or that, and what are the risks? So yes, there are opportunities there, and yes, there are risks there. But I think that sense that the technology's become the very kind of, you know, the sort of terrain through which the parent and child both struggle, and the child tries to find their own space and their own kind of domain away from the parent, you know, that's the kind of more fundamental tension, really.
Right. And how did you see that come to the fore as you navigated or talked with special educational needs and families who have children with special educational needs and disabilities?
So let me give you the example of Ryan and Amy, whose child Kyle was on the autism spectrum. And he was 13, and it was one of those kind of classic dilemmas. So he hadn't before really kind of found a thing that could engage him or that could give anyone a sense that he could really learn and express himself. And then he found this almost randomly, this kind of architectural software that he downloaded and engaged with and kind of got into in, you know, perhaps a bit of a kind of geeky way. And he loved it, and he spent hours at it. And you could see Ryan and Amy watching this and thinking, he's found something he loves, he's found something he feels, you know, he can do and is good at. Perhaps it offers him a pathway, because after all, the world needs architects, and it needs people who can use software, and it needs people who can kind of design spaces. And so they began finding supportive activities like going for a walk and kind of commenting on, you know, how was the space built and how had the shopping mall or whatever been designed. You know, they were trying to, but at the same time, you know, they and we watching thought, you know, perhaps this is going nowhere. Perhaps this is, you know, this is an incredible kind of journey they're anticipating for a boy who really has quite a lot of, you know, challenges to face in his life. And maybe it's kind of not going to take him where he or anywhere at all, and he'd be better placed doing something else. And so it was just so hard for them to know, and frankly impossible for us to know as well. But the focus of his educational special needs became kind of expressed and discussed and thought about through his engagement with the technology and with this particular piece of software. And so that kind of became the language of the possibilities and the ways that they could guide him.
Mm-hmm. And so I think the book does a really great job, as you said, you know, sort of highlighting many of the differences. But I think even in that family, with that situation, I think it's very similar to how other families sort of see technology and technological use as sort of a potential pathway, right, to their children's future. And are, you know, you use the word balance in the book. And I think that that really comes out just through the learning about the different families, but seeing that there is this commonality that all of the families are looking for this balance and for an opportunities for their children to become themselves, if you will, as adults in various ways. But I do want to kind of wrap up and ask you if you could maybe share with us sort of the big takeaway of the book. I have in my mind what the big takeaway is, but it's always great to hear what the author imagines or intends the big takeaway to be.
It's a great question. Three answers flood to mind, but if I must pick one, for me it's the way in which technology has become so much more than just the technology in our culture. And in our discourse, and in the way in which we live our everyday lives, so it's become the kind of the focus of the hopes and fears that go so much wider, and so it's gained this kind of enormous importance and the potential to put right all kinds of wrongs of injustice or inequality or exclusion, and so it has a really big job to do. And for me, that explains many of those other things about the way in which, parents love to talk about technology, or it's seen as kind of so polarizing or such a source of anxiety, or everyone is looking for advice about it. But, you know, for me, it's because it has come to play this bigger role in fixing the things that people are struggling with more fundamentally in their lives.
Right. Yes. Well, I would like to invite you to read your favorite excerpt from the book for us.
Thank you so much, Jerry. I would love to. And thinking about that, I thought I might just read the first page or two.
Okay.
If that doesn't seem, because an author rarely writes the first page first. You tend to write it later. Okay, so here we go. It's called Expectations. As we entered Lara and Pavel Mazur's small flat in a comfortable London suburb, Lara began pouring out their disagreements over six-year-old Thomas's digital media use, exclaiming how they'd been looking forward to discussing this with us. Lara, a college administrator originally from Brazil, was full of ideas to enable Thomas's online opportunities, researching educational apps and guiding his search, quote, to build his confidence and make him independent. Pavel, a chef from Poland, was worried about online risks, especially after Thomas's friends introduced him to a violent video game. Lara wanted Thomas to learn about the ways of the world, saying, "My position is to talk to him about it when it's happening. I'm very open, maybe too open." She was critical of other mums and implicitly of Pavel for his caution. Pavel, who'd set passwords for everyone on the family laptop, offered a hesitant defence. He conceded, "We need to educate him how to use the internet so he can make the right choices, but you need to be safe as well at the same time. I don't want to control. I just want to be able to view it in case there's something which I'm not able to control. Thomas told us shyly that he loved football online and offline, along with video games and playing outdoors with the neighbourhood children. His parents' divergent approaches to digital technology were not lost on the six-year-old. Thomas observed that his dad didn't always let him play his beloved FIFA when he's playing too much, but Mum usually says yes. So how should parents manage digital devices and experiences, and what should they expect of them? Why are these questions so contested within families, among policymakers, and in the media? During the fieldwork for this book, anxious, enthusiastic, defensive, or exhausted parents told us about their parenting philosophy and where they turned for inspiration or support. Some parents, and of course we include those in a primary domestic caregiving role for children, some were consumed with these questions while others seemed less bothered, whether because they had greater concerns elsewhere or had managed somehow to avoid the swirling anxiety about all things digital. As with Lara and Pavel, mothers and fathers often differed in their concerns, and social class and ethnicity also differentiated families, yet not always in predictable ways. And this diversity matters because it complicates and contests public and policymakers' assumption about the role of digital technologies in family life. Lara and Pavel's disagreement illustrates a point that we often refer to and return to throughout the book. Talk or actions that seem to concern children's digital lives are at heart rooted in parents' deeper hopes and fears for family lives and for their children's futures. So building on research conducted over 4 years with parents, children and educators, we explore the lives of families variously enjoying the pleasures and wrestling with the challenges of digital technologies. And we argue that as parents strive to understand the profound changes they're living through, digital dilemmas act as a lightning rod for contemporary contestations over values, identity, and responsibility.
Thank you again, Sonia. It was a pleasure to speak with you today.
Thank you so much, Jerry. It was fun. Good questions.